In 1987, construction began on the Ryukyung Hotel in Pyongyang, North Korea. This 105-story, 1,080-foot-tall pyramid-like skyscraper stands out well above anything else on the skyline of that city. When the project began, it was destined to be the tallest hotel in the world and would have held that that distinction until 2009. So it was a long time. However, only 5 years into construction, the project was halted. And it sat untouched for nearly 20 years. In 1992, they stopped, and basically all they had at that point was the framework. There were no windows, nothing was done. In 2011, they finally completed the exterior of the facility, and yet here we are 6 years later, and it's still unopened. It's still unused and still unfinished. It is the largest unfinished building or structure in the entire world, which is not hard to believe when you find out that it is the 63rd largest structure in the world. And it's the 10th, it is actually the 10th largest, 10th in the, I forget, I don't even know how to put this. It finished number 10 in the number of stories at 105. But the job has not been finished. Governments aren't the only ones who have a hard time finishing jobs, though. In 1900, George Bolt, the millionaire general manager of the Waldorf Astoria Hotel in New York City, and prior to that, the Bellevue Stratford Hotel in Philadelphia, commissioned the construction of a Rhineland castle to demonstrate his undying love for his wife, Louise. This castle is located in Alexandria Bay up in the Thousand Islands. How many of you have been there before? All right, many of us have seen it. This is an amazing, amazing structure. It's a six-story castle, 120 rooms. It employed 300 stonemasons, carpenters, and artists to create this masterpiece. Even the shape, the natural shape of the island was modified slightly to accentuate its heart shape, demonstrating his love for his wife. 4 years into construction and nearly completed, the workers received a telegram from Bolt that said this: immediately stop all construction. Louise had died. Bolt could not imagine his dream castle without his beloved in it. And he never returned to the island. The castle and the island sat empty, wearing down and being vandalized for nearly 75 years. Until the Thousand Islands Bridge Authority assumed ownership and began to do some measure of restoration on the facility. However, their intent is only to restore it to the point at which Bolt left it. It will forever be a job unfinished. Not finishing a job isn't something that's just something a little bit more contemporary, but it's also something that happened with the National Monument of Scotland. The National Monument of Scotland dominates the top of Calton Hill in Edinburgh, Scotland. A memorial to the Scottish soldiers and sailors who fought in the Napoleonic Wars. The inscription on the monument says this: it's a memorial of the past and incentive to the future heroism of the men of Scotland. The construction began in 1826 and was to look like the Parthenon in Greece. But due to a lack of funds, construction halted in 1829, and today it stands unfinished, also known as Scotland's disgrace or Edinburgh's folly. The job is unfinished. We've all heard it said that it's not how you start, but how you finish. So finish well, right? Why is it that so many of us, though, have so many unfinished projects? That trim that's never been put back on in the bedroom. The deck that needs stained. The clutter on our desks showing multitudes of unfinished projects. The baby's scrapbook. Yeah, I heard that. And the baby's getting ready to graduate, right? The messy garage, the overfull schedule, the unused gym membership. We all have lots of unfinished business, don't we? Why is it that we have a hard time finishing well? Over the past few weeks, we've been looking at a project, a big project, a God-sized project, the vision that God had given Nehemiah to rebuild the walls of Jerusalem. And as we've looked, we've seen the effort and the energy that it takes to complete God's project and to put into that. We've seen opposition. We've seen how opposition can be outside. Opposition can be inside. Opposition can even be inside of us that keeps us from finishing. But today, we want to look at how to finish well. How to finish the job. How to get it done. How to get that last push through to get it done. If you would, open your Bibles to Nehemiah chapter 6. Nehemiah chapter 6. You should find Nehemiah 6 on page 753 in the Bibles there in the racks in front of you. And let me just say, if you don't own a Bible, if you're using one of those Bibles, and you need a Bible, please take that home with you as a gift from us to you. Maybe you'll want to go and read the beginning of the story and get caught up to date on what's been happening there in the book of Nehemiah. I'd also encourage you in your bulletin, there are handouts you can use to follow along and take some notes as well. Nehemiah chapter 6, beginning in verse 1. Would you listen and follow along as I read? When word came to Sanballat, Tobiah, Geshem the Arab, and the rest of our enemies that I had rebuilt the wall and not a gap was left in it, though up to that time I had not set the doors and the gates, Sanballat and Geshem sent me this message. Come, let us meet together in the villages of the plain of Ono. But they were scheming to harm me. So I sent messengers to them with this reply. I'm carrying on a great project, cannot go down. Why should the work stop while I leave it and go down to you? Four times they sent me the same message, and each time I gave them the same answer. Then the fifth time, Sanballat sent his aide to me with the same message, and in his hand was an unsealed letter in which was written, it is reported among the nations, and Geshem says it is true, that you and the Jews are plotting to revolt, and therefore you are building the wall. Moreover, according to these reports, you are about to become their king, and have even appointed prophets to make this proclamation about you in Jerusalem. There is a king in Judah. Now, this report will get back to the real king, so come, let us meet together. I sent him this reply. Nothing like what you are saying is happening. You are just making it up out of your head. They were all trying to frighten us, thinking their hands will get too weak for the work and it will not be completed. But I prayed, now strengthen my hands. One day, I went to the house of Shemaiah, son of Deliah, the son of Mehetabel, who was shut in at his home. And he said, let us meet in the house of God. Inside the temple, let us close the temple doors because men are coming to kill you. By night, they are coming to kill you. But I said, should a man like me run away? Or should someone like me go into the temple to save his life? I will not go. I realized that God had not sent him, but that he had prophesied against me because of Tobiah and Sanballat had hired him. He had been hired to intimidate me so that I would commit a sin by doing this. Then they would give me a bad name to discredit me. Remember Tobiah and Sanballat, my God, because of what they have done. Remember also the prophet Noadiah, and how she and the rest of the prophets have been trying to intimidate me. as Nehemiah got close, as the Jews were getting close to finishing the project of rebuilding the walls of Jerusalem, something very significant happens. Here's what happens. When you get close to finishing, opposition may get personal. When you get close to finishing a project, if you are choosing to follow God, if you said, God, I want to follow you, I want to do what you want, I want what you want for my life, the enemy, and we've talked about who the real enemy is, the enemy, Satan, is fighting, and he is going to get personal. As you are pursuing God's vision for your life, as you are pursuing what God has for you, it is going to get harder when it gets personal. And in this passage, I see that there are three different ways that the enemy attacks us in a very personal way. The first one we see is found in verses 1 through 4, and it's this. It's by the attack of distraction. The attack of distraction. Look at what it says here. This is one of those things that, because we're not really familiar with Israelite geography, we don't understand. Okay, for us, we look at this and it says, hey, these guys come along and they say, hey, Nehemiah, okay, his enemies, the guys who've been fighting against him, causing problems all along, comes along and says, Nehemiah, look, let's go, let's get together, let's smooth things over, let's sit down and have a little chat and see if we can work out our differences. Sounds like a good thing, right? What we don't understand is they want to meet in the villages in the plain of Ono. The plain of Ono is 25 miles away. Now, for us, we might say 25 miles. You know what? If I get up early, I can meet you for breakfast. We can have our meeting, and I can get back before they start serving donuts for the mid-morning snack, okay? The mid-morning work break, right? Okay? But 25 miles for them was, that was going to be a whole day's journey. Maybe they meet that night and a whole day's journey back. And it says Nehemiah looked at them and he realized they were scheming to harm him. Now, what kind of harm were they trying to bring? We might look at that and say, well, they're trying to get him alone so they could hurt him. I don't actually think that was the kind of harm they were intending. I don't think they were going to harm him personally and individually, because he was the cupbearer to the king. And when that got back, they would be in trouble. I think the harm they were intending was harming him in the project he was leading. They wanted to get him away so that maybe they could attack Jerusalem. Maybe they could discourage the people and stop the efforts, maybe even destroy some of the efforts. But Nehemiah didn't let the distraction get in his way. It didn't let him stop. He stayed focused on what he was doing. He says, no, I'm doing an important project. Why should I stop to come down to you? Now, we all can get distracted, can't we? Okay, we live in a culture of distraction. All right? We all do it. You know, yesterday I was outside, I was working. I got up in the morning and the teens are coming over tonight, and so I knew that the grass needed mowed. And I looked at the weather report on Friday, and it was raining Friday evening. It was supposed to rain all day yesterday, and then today I'm like, I got tomorrow afternoon to get the yard mowed a little bit. I'm like, I really don't want to do that on Sunday afternoon. So I get up in the morning and the sun's shining. I'm like, okay, it's coming. Rain's coming. Early, I got to wait long enough for it to dry a little bit, and then I can mow it and all of that. And so I'm like, but I also had to get the pool chemicals done, and I had to get this done and that. And you know what happened? I went out and I started putting the pool chemicals in. Grass is drying. I'm okay. And as I'm putting the pool chemicals in, I realized that the weeds around the pool were growing up. And so I'm like, oh, I got to get rid of those weeds. And then I found some of the kids' toys laying in the yard. And so I had to pick up the toys. And you know what? I quickly became distracted from what the primary goal was. Get the yard mowed. I thought about, because that's a good illustration, but I did think about, but I didn't get permission to talk about household chores. Anybody ever get distracted doing household chores? Yeah, okay. You walk into one room, you put down one thing and pick up another thing, and all you do is just move the stuff around and everything still needs done. Okay, we all get distracted. How do we? He stayed undistracted because he said, here's the one thing on my list. Finish the wall. Done. Everything else is secondary. I think that's a good example for us. The distraction, that's something that we have to deal with in that. But say, when it didn't work, four times they try to distract him with this meeting, this unimportant meeting. You know what happens? They ramp up the opposition, and we get the second opposition. The second opposition here is found in verses 5 through 9, and they try to discredit him. They try to discredit him. They try to undermine him. Now, this part of the passage is really funny to me. It is hilarious. Sometimes we read the Bible very boringly, okay? We do. We make it boring. But this is funny. This is downright hilarious. This is like junior high, elementary schoolyard stuff that goes on right here. Okay, four times you didn't answer, so I'm going to ask you a fifth time. Come on, please meet with me. And this time, they send an open letter, an unsealed letter. Now, here's what that means. It would kind of be like writing a letter to the editor today. Like, okay, you have an issue with me, you want to talk to me, and I won't give you the time of day, so you write a letter to the editor of the Press Sun Bulletin. Okay? To tell everybody else, or maybe you put it into the Caltab Connect for the church setting. Okay? So you put it in there, an open letter about me to try to undermine me. Okay, so that's the idea. All right? That everybody that would pass, that this letter would pass, would know the contents of the letter. And catch the contents of the letter. This is so funny to me. Sounds very official. It is reported among the nations. Okay, we've already determined that Sanballat is kind of like this little minor player there in the area. He thinks he's big stuff, but he really isn't. Okay, it is reported among the nations. And Geshem says it's true. Who's Geshem? Geshem is his cohort. Geshem is the guy who's been a problem maker all along. Here's my proof. Geshem. It's kind of like this. I remember when I was in college, I had some sweet mates who were twins. Okay? Now I know we have some twins here, and I'm not going to call them out or anything. But these twins were really interesting. These two guys were so funny because they were both like 6'4", 6'5". They were identical twins. Eventually, you could tell them apart once you figured it out. But they fought endlessly, constantly. I was their RA. And I would walk back into my dorm, and I'd hear them going at it. And I'm like, this has got to stop. And you know what would happen? I would walk into the room, and I figured out how to stop the fight. All I had to do was figure out what they were fighting over and pick a side. Whatever side I picked, the person who was on that side would immediately leave that side of the argument, join his brother, and I became the bad guy. Okay? I mean, that's legitimately. And it would be kind of like saying, okay, you know what? He said it was true. Really? He said it was true? You two, like, you guys are like the same person. It doesn't stand. This is so schoolyard. This is stupid. Okay, that's what he says. I think it's so funny. It is reported among the nations. And Geshem says it's true, see? Really? That you're planning a revolt? And he says, look, you're trying to do this, and I'm going to tell the king. If you don't stop it, I'm going to tell. That's what he says, doesn't he? And the funny thing, isn't it funny? Because didn't we find out that the king's the one who sent Nehemiah and knew all about the project? He funded the project? Like, really? The king knows. I don't care. And here you get this, it becomes personal. And what would be our reaction when someone attacks us like this? How would you react? The hard part is to keep your cool. But that's what Nehemiah does. He keeps his cool and he looks at them and he says, guys, nothing like what you're saying is happening. Really, I think what went through his mind was, guys, you're really stupid. You guys are idiots. Like, I don't know what it, how we would put it this way, but it says, you are just making it up out of your head. Like, really, that's the best you could come up with? Guys, get real. But you know what he doesn't do? He doesn't react. He just kind of says, look, you're being stupid, back off. And he just keeps going. Now, it's interesting to me, though, that I do think that this one started to hit a little closer to home. Because you notice what happens at the end of verse 9? Nehemiah says, God, help me. Strengthen my hand. If they keep this up, I don't know how long I can take. I don't know how long I can hold this in. I just, you know, he probably had his, you know, his fists kept getting tighter and tighter. His knuckles kept getting whiter and whiter. God, it's yours. I'm not going to worry about it. I'm not going to defend myself. I'm going to let it go. They didn't like that. So they got more upset and they schemed even more. Verses 10 through 14. In verses 10 through 14, they take it to the nth degree. I believe this was the hardest of the three attacks. Because here's what they do. They try to deceive him and cause him to sin. But it's not, in this case, it's not Sanballat and Tobiah and Geshem. You notice who it is? Verse 10, it says it was Shemaiah. Now, you might be like, I have no idea who Shemaiah is. Here's what I know about Shemaiah. He gives kind of his lineage because we believe that indicates that he actually had a priestly role. He was one of the religious leaders. He lived inside of Jerusalem because Nehemiah didn't, once the wall started, he didn't leave. Remember, he didn't even take his clothes off. Remember, kept them on, stayed dressed, didn't shower, really stunk. Okay, he went into Shemaiah's house. Whose house do you go to? Do you go to the houses of your enemies? Do you go to the houses of random people? No. You go to the house of a friend. And Nehemiah shows up at his friend's house, who's a priest of some sort. And this guy's in on the ruse. He's like, oh, Nehemiah, they're trying to kill you. You better run to the temple. You better go into the temple and we'll hide in the temple and you'll be safe there and God will protect you there. And it was at that moment that Nehemiah realized what was going on, that they were trying to deceive him, that this was not a message from God, but a deceiving message to try to get him to sin. You see, the Old Testament law said that no one but the priest was allowed in the temple. Nobody. You did not go in there. So if Nehemiah would have gone in there, he would have been violating God's law, and they were going to use that to say, look, he doesn't care about God. He's putting himself above God. And ruin what he was trying to do. But he says, no. You might say, but wasn't there something in the Old Testament about protection? And yes, they could go grab the horns of the altar, but the altar sat outside the temple. And Nehemiah here in verses 10 through 14, we see that he says, I'm not going to do this because I know that you were trying to get me to do this because you wanted me, verse 13, you've been hired to intimidate me so that I would commit a sin by doing this. And that's why I think this hurt the most. This friend, this close confidant who should have been there for his own benefit was trying to get him to sin and was deceiving him and attacking him in this way. You know, we can all face different kinds of personal attacks like this. Distractions, when the good becomes the enemy of the best. Of being discredited, when people start to speak untruths about you to try to undermine you. And then when they really get at it and people closest to you really go after it and try to cause you to sin so that you would discredit yourself. And the reality is for all of us, we can trip at any one of these attacks. We can be caught by any of them. We're human beings and it's difficult. I found a quote from Warren Wiersbe who said this. He said this, if we take care of our character, we can trust God to take care of our reputation. I skipped ahead in the PowerPoint there. If we take care of our character, we can trust God to take care of our reputation. You see, Nehemiah had been working and doing and following God and doing what God had wanted him to do for so long, and they came in and made the opposition personal, and they began to attack him, and he didn't give into it. If we're going to finish well, if we're going to finish what we're starting, we can't give in to these types of attacks. So how do we do that? How do we handle these attacks? We work on our character. We be people of character. I think if they would have went back and told the king, Artaxerxes, he would have laughed at them. That's not the Nehemiah that I know. And God would have taken care of it. Are you the kind of person that when somebody says something bad about you, that everyone looks at, that's not that person? That's the kind of people we should be. So how do we handle these kinds of personal attacks? Nehemiah handled them this way. First of all, Nehemiah, the first thing he does is that he stayed focused. When they tried to distract him, he stayed focused. He says, no, this is my number one priority. This is what I'm going to do. Not only did he stay focused, but when they then started to make it more personal and started to say lies about him, what does he do? He keeps his cool. It's like, I'm not going to deal with you. You guys are a waste of my time. It's not true. You're making it all up. And then when they use his friend against him and they try to deceive him and they try to get him to sin, you know what? He doesn't lose it. He doesn't get defensive. He doesn't attack. See, this is where we would normally attack. We might be okay to deal with the distractions. We might be okay. Yeah, stop it. Okay, God, strengthen me. I'm good. But when it gets personal, when it's a friend who hurts us, who tries to hurt us, that's when it's like, I've had enough. I can't handle this anymore. I'm going on the attack. I got to protect who I am. And we don't do that. We've got to not be defensive. We've got to stay. We've got to keep our cool. We've got to keep our focus. And we've got to keep pursuing what God has called us to. You see, through all of this, at both the end of the second attack and the third attack, what does Nehemiah do? He prays. He continues to trust God. That's what prayer is. Prayer is trusting God. Prayer is saying, God, I've got stuff I can't handle. You handle it. I'm going to trust you. Both times. God help me. God take care of my enemies. I'm not going to worry about it. I'm not going to get off kilter. And you know what? As I think about this, this message is not be like Nehemiah. Because as I think about this, I realize this message is be like Jesus. Because Jesus, 400 years later or so, stood before Pilate. And had all these religious leaders stand up and say, oh, this guy's a horrible guy. He healed people and fed people and loved people. He was awful. They got false witnesses. They got multiple guys to come together and tell stories about Jesus, and their stories contradicted each other. And you know what Jesus did? He's like, finally, he's like, Pilate, time out. All right, this is ridiculous. You two over here, I want you to go outside. I want you to tell your stories to each other again. Get your stories together. Then come back in and see if you can tell the same story or not. And you religious leaders, you know what? I'm sick and tired of every time I turn around, you argue with me. I healed people and you don't like it? Seriously? You guys are, you know what? Angels, take care of them. Is that what Jesus did? No. Jesus, it says, like a sheep before its shears is silent. As a lamb goes to the slaughter, is quiet. He did not open his mouth. He had every right to defend himself. He had every right to be upset. But Jesus had one purpose when he was here. He had a vision for his life, and that was to give his life as a ransom for many. And he stayed focused on what God had called him to do, and he did it despite the personal attacks. Are we willing to follow Jesus that way? You know what? When you follow Jesus that way, when you do this, when you're pursuing God's vision, you will finish well. And you know what happens when you finish well? Verse 15. Look at verse 15. Verse 15 and 16 are the linchpin to this book. It says this: so the wall was completed on the 25th of Elul in 52 days. And when all our enemies heard about this, all the surrounding nations were afraid and lost their self-confidence because they realized that this work had been done with the help of our God. When they finished well, God showed up. And when God shows up, the opposition wilts. The opposition realizes, we can't do this. This has happened throughout the Israelite history. I think of the story of Jericho. You know what happened when all they did was walk around the city. And then eventually they walk around the city seven times and they yelled. And you know what happened? The walls collapsed. They defeated the city. And everybody else got scared. Why? Because God showed up. They were pursuing what God wanted to do and God showed up. You know how I know God showed up? History even tells us that God showed up here. Not just the Bible. Because 2,000 years later, in the 1500s, the Ottoman Empire, one of the great empires of its day, the Ottoman Empire came to Jerusalem to rebuild Jerusalem. They rebuilt the walls of Jerusalem, similar to the walls that the Jews rebuilt. You know how long it took them? 4 years. It took Nehemiah 52 days. And halfway through, half the guys had to stop working. God showed up. That Nehemiah was convinced of God's vision, and God showed up. And when God shows up, the opposition wilts. When we start to pursue what God wants for us as individuals and as a church, you know what? There will be opposition. It will get hard. But if we continue to pursue what God wants and we don't let a fight become a fight that we don't need to have, when we say, no, this is what will keep me going toward what God wants, God shows up. And when God shows up, amazing things happen. Are we willing to give God the opportunity to show up in our lives and in our church and in our community? Are we willing to put forth the effort? It's going to be hard. There will be opposition. There will be people who fight against you every single day. And there will be people from the inside who fight against you and fight against us. Last night, as I was reviewing my notes, and I jumped on the internet, and I realized that the opposition's showing up again. Right now. And it's fighting us and what we believe God wants us to do as a church, to love our community, be known as the church who loves our community. You know why? Because of what's going on down in Charlottesville, Virginia. That's opposition to us. I guarantee you, tomorrow morning, I will be in Subway, and one of my good friends will walk in, and one of the first things he'll say to me is, "So what do you think about Charlottesville?" Why do I have to fight that battle? Why? Like, that doesn't matter. Why are people, some of them, in the name of Jesus, supposedly, and they're not, doing some of the things that they do? And I'm going to say this. I'm not taking sides here. There's problems on both sides. There's hatred and bigotry on both sides of that argument. On both sides of those protests. I'm not here to take a stand one way. I'm here to take a stand for Jesus and say we need to love one another. and yet I'm going to have to fight that battle. And I've got to decide if I'm going to be defensive or if I'm going to push through and say, you know what matters most is loving Jesus. You know me. You know what I'm like. I don't like what they did. It's not right. And just because people say they're following Jesus doesn't mean they are. You know, and that comes through even more because unfortunately the chapter doesn't end at verse 16. Look at verse 17. It says there, also in those days, the nobles of Judah were sending out many letters to Tobiah, and replies from Tobiah kept coming to them. And Tobiah is one of the enemies. For many in Judah were under oath to him, since he was son-in-law to Shechaniah and son of Era, and his son Jehohanan had married the daughter of Meshullam, son of Berechiah. Moreover, they kept reporting to me his good deeds. Hey, he's not that bad. And then telling him what I said, and Tobiah sent letters to intimidate me. Here's the thing. When God shows up, opposition wilts, but the problems don't go away. The problems don't end. Because here's the thing. If we're going to finish well with the vision God has for us, when we get to the end of the vision, when the wall's completed, that's only step one. Because God still has us here. And if we're still here, there's a step two to take. Oh, God, here, same direction. Time to keep moving. This is just the beginning of the next set of opposition. And this opposition was coming from people who were on the inside, working with those on the outside. Frustrating as all get out. You know what? I know that there's people here today. We're sitting here and we're walking into this and we're saying, are you following God's plan for your life? And I'm telling you this, if you're going to follow God's plan for your life, it's going to be hard. Following Jesus isn't easy. It's not. And if you think it is, you've got the wrong Jesus. Because he said, if they hated me, they're going to hate you too. They persecuted me, they're going to persecute you too. Opposition's still coming. But following a God vision for our lives is worth it. Because God shows up and it's like, wow! How awesome is that? So I ask you, are you willing to finish well? Understanding that when you cross the finish line, the next race begins. And it's time to move forward. I'm going to tell you this. The only way for us to do it is for us to do it together. It really is. We've got to link arms and say, I'm with you. You're with me. When you get discouraged, give me a call. When life gets hard, I'll be here. And please, can I call you too? Because life's going to get difficult for me. Some of you are sitting here today, you're dealing with stuff that you're like, I don't know how to get out of this. I don't have a clue. This is impossible. But you know what? It is possible because God shows up. God's going to show up if you'll just keep pursuing what he wants. It may not be 52 days. It may be 52 months. It might even be 52 years. God's there. We need to keep moving toward what God's vision for who we are as a people and as a congregation ought to be.